firstly, we did find preliminary evidence of home bias. We did find a large concentration of assets remaining sort of onshore, remaining within South Africa. And that was very disproportionate to South Africa's contribution to the global GDP. In other words, we had people investing a lot in a country that doesn't have a lot of power when it comes to global markets, which is concerning, right? And that's at the heart of home bias and why home bias is problematic for various other reasons.
Have you ever wondered about how we make decisions about our money? Or why we feel the way we do about those decisions? Welcome to Nudging Financial Behavior, the podcast that aims to help you understand how and why you make certain decisions about money. Presented by Dr. Giselle Willows, an expert in behavioral finance. This podcast is all about looking at human behavior and biases, especially when it comes to your finances. You can catch the series on YouTube, the Nudging Financial Behavior blog, or on your favorite podcast platform. Be sure to like and subscribe to ensure you don't miss an episode. Special thanks to our sponsor, IG Market South Africa, a world-leading online trading provider that gives you access to opportunities across thousands of financial markets through their intuitive platforms and apps. Let's get started.
We've made it to episode 8 of the Nudging Financial Behavior podcast. I'm Dr. Giselle Willows, and we're kicking off the home stretch of season 2 by delving into home bias. See what I did there? In this series, we're breaking down human behavior and biases as we try to help you understand how and why you make certain decisions about your finances. To help with our discussion today, I've got a former PhD student of mine, Shreya Jagnandan, as my guest. She unpacked this very bias for her thesis and has some rather interesting research to share. Oh, and if you're listening to this as one of my current PhD students and you're thinking, oh dear, Giselle might call me up one day, yes, she might. Because guess what? As a researcher, you are at the forefront of the subject matter that you're researching. We want to hear what you're doing. Before we dive in though, don't forget to like and subscribe to this channel so that you know when new episodes come out. It'll cost you nothing to do so, but makes a big difference for the channel. It's fairly easy to work out what home bias is. Basically, you prefer things that are closer to home. In investment terms, you can see this bias play out in people who prefer to invest in domestic assets over foreign ones. It might not seem like a big deal to prefer investing locally, but it can be quite problematic. And that's why we look at home bias in behavioral finance. Investing locally is great, yes, but only investing locally can lead to a lack of diversification in your portfolio. And diversifying across international opportunities is often advantageous. So, why do we have home bias, or fall prey to it? Home bias stems from familiarity bias, relying on familiar information when making a decision. So, you always order the same dish at a restaurant, always shop at the same supermarket, always use the same brands over and over. There's also a bit of availability bias at play. Do you remember what availability bias is all about? It's when you place a high probability of something happening just because of a recent news story or event, even if the stats show that it's highly unlikely. Allowing our decisions to be influenced by stereotypes and what information is available to us helps create our home bias. This bias can manifest in various forms, such as favoring domestic shares, bonds, or real estate investments. Does it make sense that you'd be more comfortable with what you're familiar with? It's perhaps the illusion of control sneaking in. Remember that from the overconfidence episode in season 1.
This is when we convince ourselves that we're able to influence what happens in a situation, even if the outcome is completely a matter of chance. This is why some investors might choose to buy a large number of shares in the company they work for, because they feel they have more influence and control over how the company performs.
Because a company sells a product that you like to use, you believe that company might be a good one to invest in. And because you live in a particular country, you also believe it's a good one to invest in. Home bias exerts a significant influence on our financial choices, both overtly and subtly. You might not think that it's such a big deal to only invest in local shares and companies, but it can be problematic. Of course, it's natural to feel a sense of comfort and familiarity with local investments, but home bias can hinder wealth accumulation and limit financial diversification. In addition to that, investing in only one country presents significant political and market risks. One of the most notable effects of home bias is the reduction in diversification. Investors who are heavily influenced by this bias tend to concentrate their assets heavily in their domestic market, which can lead to heightened portfolio risk and missed opportunities for growth. And note, this isn't only relevant to those living in emerging or destabilized markets. Yes, perhaps the geopolitical risks are higher in certain economies, but no matter where you are in the world, you need to ensure you are well diversified to minimize risk in your portfolio. This lack of diversification might result in missed opportunities in sectors or industries that perform better in foreign markets. For instance, although tech giants like Apple and Amazon hail from the United States, innovative tech companies thrive worldwide. But we're going to deep dive into diversification in the next episode, so let's move on for now. Another major problem with home bias is how easy it is to get into a feedback loop. The media can play into this bias, exacerbating it in many ways. Local news is a big player here. Research has shown that local media reports of a business have an impact on purchases and sales of shares in that business. Two notable points are that the media reports have to be relevant to the investors and, unsurprisingly, negative reporting has a stronger effect than positive reporting. As an example, local radio stations or news broadcasters will preferentially report on stories about local companies. Their news bulletins will largely be focused on the city they're based in, then the rest of the country, and then only look at international news. This reporting then drives the share price of the companies covered because it is highly relevant to the local listener. But this driving of the share price would only happen if local investors were heavily invested, which shows that they're investing in familiar companies at home. There's another side effect of all this. For a company to be well known, it's most likely that it's either failing miserably or highly successful. Now, you're not going to invest in a company that's in the news for failing, but if you're investing in the well-known company, you're putting yourself on the wrong side of mean reversion. By the time the company is successful, you've already missed the largest part of its growth. Now, I'm not saying go take a gamble on unknown companies. You still need to do your research. And this is actually a good tip for both local and foreign investment opportunities. Look for where there's good growth potential. Let's look at an example. A particularly bad case of home bias is when you're overinvested in your employer. To start, if you're drawing a salary, you're already exposed to the company. If you're sitting with stock options or any similar share-based scheme, again, you have a direct investment in the company's performance or non-performance. Just because you work for someone doesn't mean you understand the business. In fact, more often than not, you'll have confirmation bias. If you're sitting in a situation where your salary, your pension, and your investment portfolio are all dependent on one company, that is not wise at all. Need I remind everyone what happened to the employees of Enron and WorldCom? And more recently, the staff of Silicon Valley Bank, who received part of their salaries in company equity, lost millions.
4 decades after its creation, Silicon Valley Bank was the 16th largest bank in the U.S. It took just a day and a half for it to fall apart.
This is the second biggest bank failure that's ever happened in the United States.
Once seen as a major tech banking player, SVB's stunning collapse spurred other bank closures, rattled global markets, and threatened the livelihoods of startups across the country.
One thing to lose your job, another to also lose your life savings. Cultural and emotional attachments also make individuals hesitant to explore foreign investments. This could be due to concerns about political stability, currency risk, or simply a sense of patriotism. This avoidance of international opportunities can expose investors to unnecessary currency risk, as well as potential losses if their domestic currency weakens compared to foreign ones. Now, this is a great spot to bring in Shreya Jagannandan, my former PhD student who went down a rather interesting path of their dissertation. Welcome to the podcast, Shreya.
Thanks, Giselle. So excited to be here today.
Let's go back to the beginning. When you first registered for your PhD, what is it that you were setting out to do?
Wow, Giselle, you're going to make me blush thinking about how ambitious that original goal was, right? So I think you and I had so many conversations around the thesis and what we set out to achieve. But I think at the heart of this thesis was trying to help people, trying to help people manage their behavioral biases, trying to prevent the layman, the individual investor, from falling prey to these vicious behavioral biases. So inherently a bit of altruism there with a huge goal, right? Trying to solve important problems by mitigating behavioral biases.
Yes, we were quite ambitious. Of course, when we're doing research, we can't just run off and assess how we manage a bias. We first have to prove that it exists. So coming back to what we're talking about in this episode, home bias, tell us what you did specifically around assessing whether home bias may or may not exist.
Yes. So I guess we had, you know, taking a step back, we had this really big goal of mitigating biases. And then we took a step back and we thought, there's so many biases out there. I mean, you know, your thought leadership, Giselle, plays a good role in illuminating the sheer volume of different permutations of biases out there. So we settled on first exploring home bias as a concept. But just like you said, it's not like you can run off and solve a problem. You need to first do some triangulation and figure out whether that problem exists. Otherwise, you're solving a problem that doesn't actually play any significant role or has any influence. So preliminarily, what we went about doing was actually trying to quantify some back-of-the-envelope calculations, some high-level data triangulation as to whether or not there was this concentration of investment locally by South Africans. In other words, overweighting South African investments relative to where South Africa sits on a global scale. So like your optimal portfolio weightings for countries. And basically, the data set used was quite a frequently used data set when it comes to home bias research. We looked at the Coordinated Portfolio Investment Survey. And that survey basically helps us understand where assets sit around the world. So how much of South African assets are invested in other countries and how much of other countries' assets are invested in South Africa. It's quite a large-scale global survey. And then we took it a step further and then we looked at various measures to quantify home bias. And not to get too technical, right? But at a very basic level, what we did was we looked at the sort of actual foreign investments by South Africa as an economy relative to the expected or optimal weighting you would expect for another country. And that optimal weighting was basically done looking at the overall contribution of each country's market cap to the global market capitalization. So it's about it's a weighting exercise. How much is out, how much is in, and comparing that to a so-called optimal weighting. Bit technical, but I hope you got a sense of what we did.
Yeah, we need to get a little technical to understand what you did. So what did you actually find when looking at that ratio?
Well, we found a couple of interesting things, right? So firstly, we did find preliminary evidence of home bias. We did find a large concentration of assets remaining sort of onshore, remaining within South Africa. And that was very disproportionate to South Africa's contribution to the global GDP. In other words, we had people investing a lot in a country that doesn't have a lot of power when it comes to global markets, which is concerning, right? And that's at the heart of home bias and why home bias is problematic for various other reasons. Almost on a rudimentary scale, if we wanted to quantify the strength of home bias, we found around 55 to 60% of assets actually sitting locally, which is concerning.
Yeah, I think the industry guidelines recommend not more than 40% in your home country. You could obviously subscribe to percentage lower than that, but that 55 to 65% is possibly too much. For interest's sake, I mean, the balance, the remaining 35 to 45%, could you see where that money was going?
Yes, we could. And some of the results were largely unsurprising. So I think a lot of South Africans love the United Kingdom. I know we see a lot of people planning to immigrate to the UK. I'm sure after the rugby, I wonder if they're thinking twice about that. But basically what we found there is that a lot of foreign investment was sitting in the United Kingdom. as well as some very strong offshore tax havens. So you're looking at low tax countries like Ireland, obviously some investments sitting in Guernsey, Bermuda, those tax havens, so to speak. And I guess some of that is sensible, right? So if you're going offshore, you want to make sure you're doing it in the most tax-efficient method possible, hence explaining those offshore financial centers like Ireland and those very fascinating islands, so to speak. And the other link to it, I guess, is the United Kingdom. So what's the big deal with the United Kingdom? There we did a bit of qualitative analysis, trying to really challenge ourselves about why the UK? And I think there are some common links from a financial services perspective. Like if you think about some of our local banks here in South Africa, tending to have strong connections to the UK. Like if you just take a layman example, for example, Investec with its UK accessibility, opening up UK bank accounts there. On the other hand, thinking about things from a juristic perspective, where some banks may actually have parent companies sitting within the United Kingdom. So looking at some social and economic entrenchment relationships between South Africa and the UK.
So then things got a little more interesting when you went out and interviewed financial planners to get their views on the prevalence of home bias with their clients. Tell us what came out of that.
Giselle, what came out of that was probably one of the most interesting parts of my research. You know, I love doing qualitative research, love talking to people, because I think behind the very exciting field of finance, there's people. There's people like you, people like me, people like, you know, the investor on the street. So what are people actually thinking and feeling? And there we found such exciting and interesting insights. So there was this really fascinating trend or disconnect between where South Africans want to live compared to where they want to invest their money. So a lot of the planners I spoke to actually experienced people seeking them out. Please help me take my money offshore. Please help me invest outside of South Africa. And it tended to be accompanied by negative sentiments, you know, not to get into some of the very outlandish statements that I heard, but people tended to have a negative outlook on the country. South Africa, from a socio-political perspective, people are upset about what they're seeing on the news. People are really influenced by talking to their peers, and they tend to get into a negative mindset about the country in and of itself. And they think to remedy that ill ease, they want to send their money offshore as fast as possible in the most efficient way possible. So they seek out a planner. So at face value, you almost find a disconnect in what investors, at least the ones that spoke to our financial planners, what they want to do with their money versus what our numbers were telling us preliminarily. Then the conversation gets even more interesting, Giselle. So the next part of the conversation tended to be the financial planner challenging the client. So you want to move such a large amount of your wealth offshore. What about liabilities matching? You know, you're going to incur costs. You have existing debt in South Africa. Why don't you just go ahead and immigrate? You know, cut ties, just move overseas if you're so unhappy with South Africa. And then many South Africans actually said no. And that's what I found very interesting. So people don't want to compromise their lifestyle here. You know, we live in Cape Town. We've got these beautiful mountains, the beach, excellent weather. People don't want to leave South Africa, but they want to send their money offshore. So this interesting tension between desired investment outcomes and where they're actually living. And that was fascinating for me to see.
And you probably find that a lot of these investors probably already had money tied up in assets in South Africa that perhaps weren't liquid enough to take offshore.
Definitely. Just also some of the wealthy clients had income generating assets here in South Africa. So a lot of their wealth was rooted in businesses they had started up here, you know, maybe a portfolio of investment properties, and feeling a sense of discomfort with actually liquidating those assets and sending it offshore. So also some emotional attachments to legacy assets that they were reluctant to liquidate.
Interesting. I want to quickly summarize because I feel like, as you would have personally experienced with your PhD, that went down all these different alleyways. So home bias, and correct me if I'm wrong with anything I'm saying here, but home bias is apparent. Obviously, we need to remember that the financial planners you spoke to are dealing with a certain subset of the market, but the data did show us that there's an over-concentration of investments locally. But then what the conversation with the planners did enlighten us on was that while their clients weren't necessarily unwilling to invest more onshore, the challenge actually came with where there was a mismatch between where you want to live and where you want to retire versus where you need to put your assets, which should be matching. And on top of that, their assets were tied up in South Africa. Many South Africans have a strange fascination with buying property. But I think the important lesson there is that you need to have assets that earn a return in your home country or where you're living and where you're retiring. And I think that's where it seems the biggest mismatch was.
Yep, yep. Fully aligned with that summary, Giselle. I think that's pretty accurate. And I think it's a watch out for as well, or maybe a contributor to our preliminary statistics as well, right? Because you have this capital that you've invested in South Africa. That's your root base, your generation of wealth. And that just stacks up in the big picture. So I think to wrap up, when thinking about onshore, offshore, it's always important to do a good stand back test. Where am I living? Where am I working? And where's my money going accordingly? Yeah.
I mean, the one nice thing about research is that we're allowed to say that unpacking all of that was beyond the scope of what you were trying to do. You were trying to develop a framework to assist planners with bias mitigation generally. Can you take us through that framework, please?
Oh, Giselle, that was such a fun part of my PhD. Maybe I'm one of the few PhD students that is fortunate enough to say they had fun doing their research, but it was a journey with you, so how could it not be fun, right? So we have done a lot of reading. Well, I did an immense amount of reading for my PhD because there is such a legacy, a volume of different efforts in the academic literature to solve many different biases. And what we really tried to do was then stitch together in a singular, cohesive, logical model how to de-bias someone. And that's a mammoth task, right? So we did a lot of qualitative analysis, and hopefully you can bring the model up on this screen so people can have a look. But the first step that we came to when doing this research is actually starting with a reflection on what do I know as the investor? And the reason we prompt the self-reflection, Giselle, is because experience is such a powerful teacher. In the literature, they did a study around students that actually have experience with debt. And they found that those students that have experiences with actually dealing with debt, managing with debt, actually better understood the effect of compound interest and were less susceptible to the hyperbolic discounting bias. So experience as a very powerful teacher is the first point in bias mitigation. Can you actually think about and reflect on, for this financial decision I'm about to make, do I have any historical experience? But experience is a double-edged sword as well, right? Because there's also research that shows that investors with too much experience may actually exacerbate their inherent overconfidence, which we know is pretty problematic when it comes to making our financial decisions. So taking a step back, step one is, what do I know? If I don't know enough, what am I going to do about it? Is there a need to then improve my intrinsic knowledge? If the answer is yes, then we then encourage investors to go ahead and obtain some specific training for the decision that they are about to make, the current decision that they are having to confront themselves with. So do some research or see if you can't do some or seek out some specific training opportunities to help equip you with the baseline knowledge to make that call. If you don't need to improve your knowledge, the next step is to go ahead and seek what we called a decision support system, a DSS. And a DSS could either be something digital or it could be a person. Ultimately, you need something to help you make that decision. When I say a digital tool, it could be some investment software, some platform that helps you look at your information maybe quantitatively and qualitatively. So maybe looking at some pictures or the numbers, trying to help you make that decision. Another DSS is something we are very fond of, and that's actually seeking out a financial planner. So using the financial planner as a platform or a method to help you reach a decision. So helping support you in making that decision. Now, depending on the decision support system that the investor ultimately settles on, they would then need to obtain appropriate information particular to the decision support system. I guess if you use a financial advisor, you'd have to provide them with the requisite information to help you make that decision. If you're using some form of, you know, computer software or some computer system, you'd need to then go ahead and seek out that historic and future looking type of data to basically give yourself the required inputs in feeding through the data through that decision support system. And that high level will help you conclude on your decision. And once you've concluded on your decision, the funny thing is that you've then actually created experience for yourself. So you've learned some lessons by going through this whole process. So when you make your next financial decision and you're doing that stand back test around, do I have the experience to make this decision? Hopefully you do. So it's a circle. It's a self-fulfilling model almost, the one we've come up with and we've just chatted about. I hope that makes sense.
Makes complete sense, to me at least. It's brilliant. And to those listening and watching, this particular framework and the final results of Shreya's dissertation have actually been published in the International Journal of Consumer Studies. So I'll definitely link to that in the show notes if anyone's interested in knowing more or applying or looking at this framework in a little more detail. Thank you so much for your time, Shreya. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Giselle. It was great to be here.
I wish I could say that home bias was easy to understand and easy to overcome. There are so many forces at play. And as you can see from Shreya's research, it's not a linear progression. What's important to know is that home bias can have a significant impact on our financial decision-making, potentially limiting our returns and increasing risk. By understanding the nature of this bias, recognizing its effects in everyday life and investment choices, and implementing strategies to overcome it, we can take informed and balanced steps towards building a resilient and diversified financial portfolio. In the next episode, we're going to unpack how to overcome home bias and ensure that you have a truly diversified portfolio. But before I go, you know I have to remind you to hit the like button for this episode and make sure you have subscribed to our channel. Thanks in advance.
That was Nudging Financial Behavior, hosted by behavioral finance expert, Dr. Giselle Willows. Make sure you like and subscribe so that you don't miss an episode. You can catch the Nudging Financial Behavior podcast on YouTube, our blog, or your favorite podcast streaming platform. Thank you again to our sponsors, IG Market South Africa, for helping to bring the show to life. And now for the disclaimer. This podcast should not be seen as advice. All the information and opinions are of a general nature. They are not intended to address the needs or circumstances of any individual. We are not financial advisors, neither are any of our staff or service providers, nor is our sponsor. All expressions of opinion by the host or guest are subject to change without notice in reaction to shifting market conditions. Any information you get from us should be seen as only that, information only.